Well, my notes tell me, before we begin with our second case of the day, that we have some students here from Bigfoot High School. If that's true, will they and their advisors please stand? Oh, my, wonderful. Thank you very much. Please be seated. Where is Bigfoot High School? Walworth? Okay, thank you very much. Well, we like to have you come. The students are here on a program we operate in conjunction with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they've had an opportunity to learn a little bit about the case that they're going to hear this morning. And if you all can stick around after the court is done with argument, I will come down and chat with you a little bit. Not about the merits of the case that counsel is going to argue, but just about how cases get to the Supreme Court, how long it takes to get here, a little bit of the underpinnings that go on for every case. So I hope you'll be able to stay, and if you can, I'll just walk around the side of the bench and I'll come join you as soon as the argument is over. We also have a little bit of a different breakdown of timing here, and I'm going to go with it, and if I'm not saying it the way you all think is correct, you please correct me as we go, okay? So we're going to begin with 18 minutes by Attorney Hurtle. Hurtle, thank you. I had the accent on the wrong syllable, right? Okay. And then 7 minutes by Attorney Robinson, 30 minutes by Attorney Sweatlick. Okay. And Sweetlick? Thank you. Thank you very much. And then 5 minutes again by Attorney Robinson. Okay, so that seems like I've got the timing down right. Are you prepared to begin?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court, Mr. Sweetlick. My name is Harry Hurtle from Eau Claire. I represent Robert Shugarts II and his wife Judith in regards to this underinsured motorist case. Bob Shugarts was injured on October 11, 2010 while acting in his official capacity as a deputy sheriff of Eau Claire County. He'd received radio transmissions of a driver who turned out to be Dennis Moore, the original defendant in this case, operating in a dangerous and erratic manner. He tried unsuccessfully to get him to pull over in response to lights and siren, and in efforts of another officer to play stop sticks across the highway to puncture his tires also failed. The two vehicles left the vicinity where the stop sticks were, and Deputy Shugarts determined he would pull in front of Mr. Moore's vehicle in an effort to slow him down and bring him to a stop. Instead, Mr. Moore smashed into his vehicle, and Deputy Shugarts was injured. The only witnesses to the accident itself were Deputy Shugarts and Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore was criminally prosecuted. Now, Progressive Insurance was the insurance company for Mr. Moore's vehicle and resisted paying under its liability coverage for 4 years and 2 days and first offered its policy limits on October 13, 2014. 15 days later, notice was sent to Allstate Insurance, which was Deputy Shugarts's personal private insurer, advising them of a possible underinsured motorist or UIM claim. After no response from Allstate, further correspondence was sent on January 9, 2015, noting again the case itself and requesting a copy of the policy as Mr. Shugarts did not have one. That policy is the foundation for why this review has been sought from this court. In both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, the policy was interpreted in a fashion which we contend was inconsistent with the precedents decided by this Supreme Court, and also inconsistent with the policy language itself. Both prior courts created a requirement that something other than a proof of claim had to be provided once a claim came into existence, instead indicating that some type of notice, either of an accident or a loss, was somehow the necessity, even though it does not appear in the UIM coverage. And even though all the cases regarding UIM coverage do not indicate the need for any such notice, only of a proof of claim. What is significant is that the policy itself contains reference only to a proof of claim in the UIM coverage. The policy states, as soon as possible, you or any other person making claim, not loss, not an accident occurred, must give us written proof of claim. It must include all details we may need to determine the amounts possible to be owed. Policy further states, in what is known as an exhaustion clause, we are not obligated to make any payment for bodily injury, until after the limits for all liability protection have been exhausted by payment of judgments or settlements. This latter language has been something which this court here has reviewed at length in prior decisions. Policy language requires a proof of claim under circumstances that create the obligation on the part of Allstate, the liability on the part of Allstate. Until there exists a claim, there is no liability, and there cannot be a proof of claim made until a claim actually occurs.
Counsel, is it necessary that the claim accrue as a matter of law before there is an obligation to give notice to the insurance company of a claim that you knew you had?
And looking at your court's decisions in the past, particularly Yelkerer and Danbeck, Danbeck, it's pretty certain that it's always been viewed as that there is no claim that can exist, and there's no reference to any other notice being necessary. And
right. So is that true as a matter of statute of limitations or for the purpose of notifying of that you have a claim?
In this instance, where the policy says the first thing you provide is a proof of claim, the case law establishes, not just for the statute of limitations, but for the very nature of a possible claim itself, is that certain prerequisites have to exist. One of those is the signing of the release forms. Another could be the payment of policy limits, a judgment which is entered which reflects the policy limits or greater. Those are options which trigger the existence of this potential claim.
Okay, but is a factual matter, though. You knew you had a claim as soon as you saw the policy declaration page, right?
Actually, we knew that the policy declaration was $50,000. Mm-hmm. However, in this particular instance, the primary vehicle coverage was believed to be with Eau Claire County through their insurer, Wisconsin Municipal Mutual Insurance Company, or Wisconsin Mutual, I'd refer to it as. And so our original effort was at focusing on their potential liability for underinsured coverage. I think the fantasy that I had was that there would be stacking of every single squad car and truck owned by Eau Claire County, but that decision had come down after the time of this accident saying, no, that's not what applies for the county. And another case indicated that the county can exclude employees and their volunteers from any underinsured claims that could arise through the use of their vehicles.
And when did you learn that the county's policy was not going to be applicable in this case?
It was asserted by the representative, Attorney Gallagher, on behalf of Wisconsin Mutual that particular case applied. We disputed that because it arose during Truth in Insurance when there was specific language about what needed to be included. But in reality, that exclusion received a approval despite the fact that in the case in which it was decided, there was a requirement of provision of underinsured coverage for people in the vehicle, and this court had ruled no, that wasn't necessary.
Yeah. So what was the date on which you learned there was going to be no coverage under the county's policy?
We would have been told about that during the period of time leading up to, prior to July 29, 2014, there was an allegation made by Attorney Gallagher. But we amended in our third amended complaint to bring Wisconsin Mutual into the case for declaratory relief to see if their position was correct.
Mm-hmm. And when was that resolved?
That was actually resolved as a result of first the court's decision in the circuit court and then in the context of the Court of Appeals case.
Yeah. Hang on a second. Let me just make this really easy for you. What I'm interested in is how that relates to the date that you gave the policy that we're talking about. Notice that you've got a claim for underinsured coverage.
Okay. At the time in which we gave notice to Allstate, we still had maintained our claim against the county but raised the issue of declaratory relief being considered by the court as to whether it applied. When we added Allstate to the claim, our complaint also indicated that we were looking for declaratory relief as to which of the companies would be priority and was there insurance from the county. When the case submitted to the Court of Appeals led to the brief from Ms. Gallagher and I reviewed the case law, I talked with my client and we concluded that that would likely be, matter of fact, we were convinced it would be a fruitless claim at that point. But prior to that, we still believed and hoped that there would be coverage as much as $1 million available for underinsured motorists under the primary vehicle, the squad car itself.
But you amended your complaint to add the county's insurer. Was that in July of 2014?
July 14th, yes, that's correct.
Sorry, July 2014.
Oh,
we're trying to get,
right.
I think we are all trying to establish the timeline because I think that's important to the resolution of the issue.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. Can I clarify something in my mind? If you were to prevail, you would be asking this court to reverse and remand, right?
That's correct, because there would be further obligations as to whether or not there would be a hearing on damages.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Why shouldn't the remand be for a factual determination of whether 14 months is as soon as possible and whether there's prejudice?
Okay. In this situation, the court made the decision on those two issues, and part of what we hope this court would decide is that under 83161, the issue of prejudice does not even apply when we're dealing with a proof of claim as opposed to a proof of loss, and when that particular statute says that it can be up to a year after the period of time indicated in the actual policy itself. Here the policy discussed providing a written proof of claim, and all of the case law in existence at that time and still in existence dealing with underinsured motorist coverage other than the Shugarts case indicates that the claim doesn't even exist until such time as one of those conditions precedent are met, such as policy limits paid, releases signed, judgment in the actual litigation, anything of that nature. And so the remand, we believe from this court, should be that we don't even get to a decision regarding prejudice, and there'll be some factors I'll mention in regards to the Court of Appeals decision as to show why that prejudice issue is also something that shouldn't be considered any further.
And where will I find the factual findings that 14 months is as soon as possible?
In this instance, if I recall the nature of the decision from the Court of Appeals.
They're not fact finder, so.
I'm sorry?
The fact finder.
Oh, Judge Schumacher, there was a oral decision which was reached that took place on. We had an oral argument with Mr. Sweetlake that took place on.
Was that in March 2016 when the court granted summary or declaratory judgment for Allstate?
Oral argument was March 16th, and the actual decision occurred on March 23rd in a telephonic conference with all counsel participating. The actual judgments which were granted did not provide written detail, but the actual transcript of the court's ruling does have reference to the determination that is dovetailed with the court's inquiry here.
So where are the factual findings? Just give me a point in the record. You don't have to recite it to me. I can look it up myself. That 14 months is as soon as possible.
I would honestly tell you that I'd have to take a look in the transcript to give you an idea because there was not a written findings of fact, to the best of my knowledge, and Mr. Sweetley can address that as he was the one most interested in submitting the paperwork to the court.
Okay. If it isn't there, do you think we have to remand for that determination?
If this court determines that there is no requirement for a notice of an accident or notice of a loss, but under this policy only proof of a claim, and follows the precedence of this court in the Vogt case, the Raines case, the Yokerer case, and the Danbeck case, a claim doesn't come into existence about which you can submit proof until there actually has been the condition precedent met.
It's a UIM claim.
I'm sorry?
A UIM claim.
A UIM claim, that's correct.
About.
Very
that's
different from an underinsured motorist claim.
That's what I'm trying to point out, or a claim under the other liability policy.
Yes. Liability or uninsured, the insurance company is responsible for $1. In this case, Allstate is responsible for the 50,000th and penny, $50,000 and one penny level of obligation. Until that $50,000 has been tendered and accepted and the release is signed, there is no responsibility, and there is even an exhaustion language that's contained within the policy which says that they're not obligated to do anything until that original tortfeasor's policy has been exhausted. In other words, you could give them a notice the day of an accident, and there's no obligation on their part. There is no liability. You can't sue them for it. You can't ask for arbitration on it. The insured has no ability to do anything other than to simply wait and see what happens with the tortfeasor.
Counsel,
that is the trigger.
The policy, we're talking about contract language here, so the insurance company could have required, if it wanted to, that in an underinsured motorist claim, it could say, you have to give us notice of the accident, right? And it could say, you have to give us notice of how much you're going to claim against us before the claim accrues. They could require that, right?
They could theoretically, but someone who doesn't have an attorney, who's got a soft tissue injury and thinks his case is worth $1 million, is in a position to send his letter saying, I want $1 million or whatever the case may be. The insurance company is unlikely to do anything in that nature.
Okay.
As a matter of fact,
That's a downstream question.
Yeah.
I want to concentrate right now on what the insurance company can ask for.
And
so they could ask for proof of claim before the claim accrues.
I don't believe they can ask for proof of claim. I think they can ask for a notice of an accident in which the person, either as a driver of a vehicle insured, a driver of another vehicle, or a passenger in any other vehicle,
okay,
or
so
the insured vehicle.
Why would they not be able to require proof of claim before the claim accrues?
Because the fact is that the actual existence of the claim may or may not be a reality. It may be less than $50,000. You could have someone who has significant medical bills and actually says, I had terrible pain and suffering, and a jury comes back and awards $40,000, for example, if that had happened here. All that notice, all that effort of somehow putting Allstate in a position to deal with the circumstances is a waste of time and energy.
Well, it might be, but we're not dealing with that. We're just dealing with the contract language.
Yeah.
Right?
And
what I need to know is whether an insurance company is precluded as a matter of law from requiring proof of claim before the accrual of the claim.
In responding to that, I would say that we are seeking from this court a determination that the decisions in the four cases cited, including Yoher and Danbeck, established the real procedure for any type of notice for underinsured motorists. So there's no confusion that a UIM claim is triggered and requires no prior notice. Now, the court may not reach that conclusion, but we would ask it to do so, because otherwise every company could put their own separate form in an insurance policy, and you could have 30 or 40 different types of notices.
But that's part of what we need to do, right? I mean, this is a contract, and we need to construe the contract. We're not going to rewrite it, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
We're not going to rewrite the contract.
Right? No, you're not.
Right. So we take the contract as it comes to us,
yes,
and we try to figure out what does this contractual language mean.
But the essence of your argument, and this is a follow-up, if I may intercede, Justice Kelly, I think the argument you're making is that there's a difference between a loss and a claim. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And as I understand it, there's probably no dispute that Mr. Shugart experienced a loss as a result of this accident. You're claiming lost wages, medical expenses, and a reduction in retirement benefits. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. But that's a loss. That's not a claim.
Correct.
The essence of your argument is that the claim could not accrue until Progressive tendered its limits.
Yes.
Correct.
And there's no obligation.
So how could he prove something that doesn't exist? Is that what your argument is?
Exactly, Justice
okay,
Bradley.
Thank you.
Exactly. And literally, we've been faced with, should we be sending notices on every single personal injury case that comes in because of the Court of Appeals decision? Because we don't know what a jury's going to do. We don't know what a client's case may be worth. We may go to mediation and discover that it's not worth what the client thinks it is. It may be under the amounts, but if we've already put them on notice, are they going to be involved? I can tell you the response to any letters that we would have sent so far, and we've sent some, has been no action taken by the insurance company. They want to wait till they get the policy limits tendered. That's when they are actually in a position to owe money. I see my lights on here. I just want to, if I may, jump to the question about prejudice.
You have, 5 minutes from the time the yellow went on. You'll get a red when it's time to change for your college.
I may start talking faster, for which I apologize. The issue of prejudice, I thought, was just a straw man here in the decision from the Court of Appeals. There was first the contention that memories were going to fade and they were entrenched. All of the memories of the two people involved in the accident were still in existence because those people had their memories intact.
Do we even get to prejudice, though, if we accept your argument? Because doesn't the statute speak to proof of loss again? And you're talking about the insurance policy requiring proof of claim. There's no requirement for UIM claim to provide notice of an accident or proof of loss. Is that right?
That's correct. I simply want to buffer that there is no need to get to that. But if you look at what the court did, it ignored the fact that there were police reports that entrenched what happened within 48 hours to 72 hours of the accident itself. This is not like lay persons who are going to forget something or aren't questioned. This is a circumstance in which the prejudice is non-existent because the reports that existed from law enforcement, who were all of the participants at the scene after the accident, existed for their review. It's not like memory changing. They're not going to change the reports, and they're certainly going to be impeached if they change what they say in the reports.
Thank you.
You do have a red light now.
Thank you very much.
We will now hear from Attorney Robinson. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you briefly this morning. I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Association for Justice, and we understand that you are called as justices to be experts on every area of the law, given the number of issues that come up before you. The role of our organization is when we have an issue that pertains specifically to what our members do as trial lawyers that practice civil litigation and affects the rights of our clients, we want to provide assistance to the court if we can to help them better understand issues so that decisions may be reached considering all proper considerations. I'm old enough to remember the Federal Express guy. Now we have the Jimmy John delivery guy, so I'm going to talk very fast since I don't have a lot of time. In order to, the Court of Appeals decision, when you step back and look at it, it looks like it was a decision that was based more on the optics of the situation rather than the reality of the situation. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is the accident happened in October of 2010, yet the first time maybe Allstate got notice of a potential underinsured motorist claim is October of 2014, and there's a dispute about whether that letter reached them or not, but for sure by February of 15, more than 4 years later. And so looking at it from that standpoint, you know, holy smokes, why wasn't notice given earlier? Someone could be scratching their head. But that's not the issue here. The issue before the court is not whether notice was given earlier, whether it could have been given earlier than it was, but the policy or law required notice to be given earlier than it was. And so what we need to do to understand this issue is we need to look, obviously, at the policy first, but we also need to look at this court's decision and precedent dealing with underinsured motorist claims. It's an important starting point to recognize that underinsured motorist coverage is excess coverage. It provides, according to this court, compensation above the underlying limits of the at-fault driver. So because of that, there is a necessary condition precedent, a contingency that must be satisfied before the insured has an obligation to pay underinsured motorist benefits. Conversely, before the insurance company has an obligation to pay, and conversely, before the insured has the right to make a claim, to present a demand and say, please pay me. And that condition precedent is exhaustion of the underlying limits. That's set forth in Allstate's policy. That's a standard provision. We have no obligation to make any payment under this section, says the policy, until the underlying limits are fully exhausted. This court said in the Yoker case in footnote 3, and I want to read this because this helps shed light on this. We note that other policies have specifically required either judgment or settlement of underlying liability policies before coverage will be provided, and they cited the prior decision of this court in Danbeck. Here's the key language. Such language provides a clear indication of when the policy comes into play and when a presentable claim exists for the insurer. The simple truth of the matter is, whether notice could have been given at an earlier time or not, that's not the issue. The issue is whether the policy or case law required notice to be given earlier than it did. And the Court of Appeals said if notice should have been given at the latest by August of 2013. That date is significant. Why? That's the date counsel first learned what the underlying liability limits were. But guess what? On that date, they weren't offering the full $50,000, let alone it hadn't been exhausted. They were only offering $10,000 of the $50,000.
But we know at that point, counsel knew that there was a claim of something in the neighborhood of $700,000. Right?
That's correct.
So if the tortfeasor's policy had a limit of $50,000, then he knew he had at least an underinsured claim of $650,000, right?
Right, but the policy, is there a requirement under the policy? This was your question before. Can a policy require, in an underinsured context, the insured to give notice of the details of the accident? We know that provision exists under Allstate's policy under the liability section, but not under the UIM. That's an issue for another day, I suppose. The fact of the matter is, a notice of accident provision doesn't appear under the underinsured provision.
It's just a proof of claim.
Exactly.
So could the insurance contract require that the insured provide proof of claim before the claim accrues as a matter of law?
I don't know the answer to that, but I would think that if the policy had clear language to that effect, that would be helpful for the insurance company. It would be a starting point. We don't even have that starting point here.
Well, it says the insured needs to provide proof of claim as soon as possible.
That's not what it says. With all due respect, what it says, Your Honor, is as soon as possible, comma, you or a person making a claim must provide us with proof of loss.
Proof of claim. Want to make sure we get our terms right. Proof of claim.
Right.
So it's as soon as possible after a UIM claim is made, not as soon as possible after the accident.
That is what we believe a plain language interpretation of a provision like that would support at a minimum. There's an ambiguity when you read that provision in light of the exhaustion provision that appears, I think, four paragraphs earlier in the UIM endorsement that tells the insured that until the underlying limits are paid, you don't have the right to make a claim. So the point would be, why should an insured be required to present medical records, wage loss documentation, other information to support an underinsured motorist claim before they even have the right under the policy to make and present that claim? That's the absurdity. The other way I would view this is, if we take the Court of Appeals, their August date, as the last date by which counsel should have provided them notice of a potential UIM claim. If medical records, wage loss documentation, all of the documentation Allstate needed to evaluate the claim had been sent in August of 13 before Progressive had paid the underlying limits, would Allstate have offered money? Would they have offered a dime under the underinsured motorist provisions at that point when the necessary precondition for that coverage, to trigger that coverage, payment of the limits had not been met? And the answer is clearly, of course not. So the Court of Appeals has interpreted the provision improperly in the policy to require an insured to give proof of a claim that doesn't even exist at a time before it even exists. And the statute doesn't help. The statute that talks about prejudice, oh, my time is up. Can I just complete this thought?
You can complete the sentence.
Because that statute does not dictate when an insured must provide notice under a policy. It just deals with what is the effect of failing to provide notice within the time frame required by the policy. What's the effect? And that statute says, well, as long as you provide the notice within a year of the time it was required in the policy, your claim doesn't go by the wayside if you can rebut a presumption of prejudice to the insurance company. But it's tied into when does the policy require the notice. And the Allstate policy doesn't require notice as soon as possible after the accident, but as soon as possible when you can make the claim,
which didn't
happen yet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I think that the best way to analyze this case is to look at the rights and the responsibilities of the parties under the insurance contract and also under Wisconsin law. There's been a lot of talk so far about different case law that deals with the responsibility of an insurance insured to provide notice of a tentative settlement in order to preserve subrogation rights. There's also been discussion of when the statute of limitations begins to run for purposes of an underinsured motorist claim. I would submit to the court that the most important consideration is the purpose of the clause that is contained in the Allstate policy.
And is it the purpose or the actual text of the clause that's most important?
Well, the text and the purpose, I think, are both very important.
How do we define the purpose if we don't just look at the text?
Well, what I meant when I said the purpose of the clause, I meant to read the whole thing together. I'm not trying to run away from the language of the clause. What I'm saying is that this particular provision not only requires that the proof of claim be provided as soon as possible, but it also speaks to the rights of the insurance company to investigate, evaluate, and settle, which historically has been the purpose or has been the consideration that the court has given when they look at these cases that talk about the responsibility to provide a proof of loss or a proof of claim.
Counsel, do you have standing to participate in the case before the claim accrues as a matter of law?
Well, I can tell you that from a practical point of view that it happens all the time.
I'm not interested in a practical point of view at this point, just a question of law. Do you have the right to participate in the disposition of the case before the claim accrues as a matter of law?
Well, I don't think I would have the right to move to intervene. But I do know that it happens quite often that when the lawsuit is commenced against the tortfeasor, that the UIM carrier is sued at the same time. And I would also point out that the purpose of the Volt case is to point out the interest of the insurance company in protecting their right to subrogation, so that there is the potential that an underinsured motorist carrier could become involved in a case at an early stage and settle that case. That's an option they're given under Volt to preserve subrogation rights. So I think that that's why I say that when we look at the provision that we're construing here, I mean, I'm not running from the language, but we also look at the purpose of the provision. And again, it's to get the right to do the investigation, the evaluation, and the opportunity at settlement at an early stage.
Counselor, when you answered Justice Kelly's question in part by saying that you wouldn't have a right to intervene, so if you were not named in this lawsuit, when could you have the right to intervene?
I think that the right to intervene would occur upon the final resolution of the underlying claim.
When you say the final resolution, do you mean the determination of liability as well as any coverage issue?
Well, you know, in the Yokochirc case, the final resolution is defined as either the denial of the claim or the settlement of the claim or a judgment on the claim.
But when you say the claim, is it the claim against, can't be the insurance company for UIM coverage if you're not part of the claim. So when you're talking about that claim, at that resolution of that claim, what is it that you're talking about?
I think it would be the underlying claim against the underinsured motorist and the underinsured motorist's insurer.
But you couldn't resolve that claim if the claim against you would not accrue.
Right, it's first-party coverage. So I thought your answer was very interesting, and that's what I'm trying to understand it a little bit better. You said you wouldn't have a right to intervene, and Justice Kelly asked you, well, if you were sued early on, you say, well, that's not unusual. But what I was most interested in your statement is that you wouldn't have a right to intervene, and my question was, well, when could you intervene? And you said upon final resolution of the claim. Now I'm trying to figure out what claim. Is it the plaintiff's claim against the tortfeasor?
Yes.
Is it the plaintiff's claim against the tortfeasor's insurer? I don't know what claim we're talking about.
I would think that it would normally be the claim against the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance company.
Okay, so then if that's the case and this matter proceeds through trial, and there's a judgment against the tortfeasor for $600,000, you could still be sued then at that point, right?
You could be sued once the resolution occurs, yes.
Okay, all right.
Doesn't Yokerer directly answer that question?
I'm sorry, what question?
Doesn't the case of Yokerer directly answer that question?
I'm confused at the question. The question of when the statute of limitations begins to accrue?
The statute Yoker reads as follows. For actions seeking coverage under an underinsured motorist policy, the statute of limitations begins to run from the date of loss, which is the date on which a final resolution is reached in the underlying claim against the tortfeasor, be it through denial of the claim, settlement, judgment, execution of release, or other form of resolution, whichever is latest.
Correct. That is what it says. I don't think that Yokerer speaks to the issue of providing proof of claim. I think the Martinson case is the case that speaks to that issue most directly. I think that the fact that a claim for underinsured motorist coverage does not accrue and the statute of limitations does not start to run until there's a final resolution does not mean that an insurance company cannot reserve by contract the right to receive notice of claim in an earlier stage so that they can protect their interest to investigate, evaluate, and settle.
Let me ask you about what the policy is referring to when it references proof of claim. The policy language says it, meaning the proof of claim, must include all details we may need to determine the amounts payable. There's no way Mr. Shugarts could have provided proof of a claim until he knew first what Progressive was or was not going to pay and what the county's insurer was or was not going to pay. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would agree with that in part. I think that the reason that the provision talks about as soon as possible is that there needs to be a development of the claim before the notice of claim can be provided. I don't agree that the notice of claim cannot be required before the settlement with the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance company has been accomplished.
But how could Allstate, under these facts, determine the amounts payable under Allstate's policy until those two claims were resolved by settlement or otherwise?
You mean the claims against the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance company?
Mm-hmm. And the county's insurer.
Well, I think that Allstate was always of the belief, based on the pertinent case law, that the county's policy wasn't going to apply. In terms of how they would know, there was a policy limit in the Progressive policy of $50,000. There was at least an allegation that the case had substantially more value. I believe that there was a demand for $600,000. There was an allegation that the claim for loss of earning capacity was $645,000. In fact, I think the medical expense standing alone almost equaled the policy limit of the Progressive policy.
What that tells me is that Mr. Shugarts could have put Allstate on notice that there may be a claim made under the policy. But that's not what the policy requires, right? The policy requires Mr. Shugarts to give proof of claim, and that's an amount that is calculable. It's the amount payable. But that, how do you calculate that until those amounts are resolved with respect to the county's insurer and Mr. Moore's insurer?
Well, honestly, I think the Court of Appeals got it right when it considered that issue. The proof of claim was actually provided by Mr. Shugarts to Progressive in April of 2013. And then in August of 2013, Shugarts was provided with the information regarding the amount of coverage that was available under the Progressive policy.
What did Mr. Shugarts provide in, I think you said, August of 2013? What did he provide to Allstate? Was it an amount that was calculated?
If I said Allstate, I apologize. I misspoke. Mr. Shugarts provided information in April of 2013 to Progressive that was essentially a proof of loss, proof of claim. It was a document that itemized, well, first of all, discussed the liability issues. It itemized all the damages, and it made a demand for $600,000.
That's a proof of claim with under Progressive's policy, but we're talking about the proof of claim under Allstate's policy. It's different, isn't it? Because it's UIM coverage, not first-party liability coverage.
Well, I agree that it's different, but I also think the policy says that that proof of claim should be provided as soon as possible. And I think it was possible to do it then because it was given to Progressive at that time. The information was available.
But there's a difference between proof of claim under the Progressive policy, right? That's liability coverage for Mr. Moore for his actions, and proof of claim under a UIM policy for Allstate. I think we're talking past each other a little bit. The proof of claim under Allstate's policy must include details that we, Allstate, need to determine the amounts payable under the Allstate policy. That's very different from the amounts payable under Progressive's policy insuring Mr. Moore.
I would agree with that, and I'm sorry if we're not connecting here. But I think that, as the Court of Appeals points out, that once Mr. Shugarts knew that the policy limits available to the tortfeasor were limited to $50,000, and he had already presented a proof of claim 4 months earlier, wherein he asked for $600,000 and he itemized damages of substantially more than that, it was possible for Mr. Shugarts at that time to provide a proof of claim to Allstate. And that's what the policy says.
And what amount would Mr. Shugarts have provided to Allstate as this is the amount that you're going to have to pay because I've got an underinsured motorist who struck me?
I think that what he would have said is that my damages are clearly going to exceed the $50,000 policy limit that's available under the Progressive policy as set forth in my proof of loss from April of 2013. And therefore, I'm providing this notice of claim to you so that you have the opportunity to do the things that are called for in the same provision to investigate, evaluate, and try to settle.
But at that point, Allstate could not have determined the amount payable under its policy, right? Because Progressive had not tendered its limits, and we still didn't have a determination of what would be owed, if anything, under the county's policy.
Well, honestly, I think that Allstate could have made the decision that we're going to take the bull by the horn and we're going to settle the case. And then we'll retain our subrogation rights against Mr. Moore and Progressive Insurance Company. That's what vote allows. That's a right that vote provides to underinsured motorist carriers.
There's no suggestion by Allstate, though, that Mr. Shugarts violated vote. He followed it, didn't he?
No, there's no suggestion that Mr. Shugarts violated vote. The point that we make is that vote applies to subrogation rights, and vote does not say that an insurance company does not have the contractual right to ask for a notice of claim before either there's been a tentative settlement with the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurance company, or before the statute of limitations starts to run on the claim for underinsured motorist benefits. That's what our point is.
But the contract that we're looking at, though, the language says as soon as possible, comma, you or any other person making claim. There's been a suggestion that the reference to the claim there is making a legal claim. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I don't read it that way.
Okay.
I think that the intent.
How do we distinguish between a legal claim and whatever other kind of claim you might want to characterize this as?
Well, I think that the intent of the provision is that there be notice of the claim, which I think is akin to the notice of loss. I know that there's been a distinction that has been raised between the two terms, that the loss is just what the numbers are, and the claim is actually the right to present the claim. I would submit to the court that the purpose of the provision really is to give Allstate notice of this claim and what the claim amounts to as soon as it's possible to do that.
But okay. Allstate knows how to do that, right? Because they did draft a clause under the bodily injury and property damage provision, Part 1, which the Court of Appeals said does not apply to UIM coverage, And it provides a notice to the insured of what he's supposed to do when he has an auto accident. Must be notified of all the details as reasonably possible. But that was not in the UIM section.
I acknowledge that. That provision is in the liability section, and it's not in the underinsured motorist section of the policy.
So what textual clues do we have from which we can conclude that the reference to the claim does not refer to a legal claim, but to a nascent inchoate claim?
Well, I think that the best answer I have for that, Your Honor, is that I would rely on this Court's decision in the Martinson case. And I understand that that's a claim for uninsured motorist coverage rather than underinsured motorist coverage. But I think if you look at the language of the provision, it's almost identical.
Yeah, and but isn't it significant that that's first party, first dollar coverage?
Well, I know that that's the argument that has been made. I think that if you look at the facts of the Martinson case, we had a situation where the uninsured driver was the driver of the car that the plaintiff was in. And the claim was initially, the lawsuit was filed against the other driver. And then I believe the other driver and the other driver's insurance company third-partied in the uninsured driver. But the case went to trial, and the other driver was found to be free of negligence. And then that's when the lawyers provided the notice of claim to the uninsured motorist carrier. So even though it's dollar one coverage, the facts are kind of similar insofar as there was this delay that was created by the strategy that was employed by the lawyer who represented the plaintiff in suing out his case and suing the other driver rather than the host driver who didn't have insurance. And rather than the uninsured motorist carrier was not included in the suit until after that determination was made. So I would rely on the Martinson case that was decided by this court in terms of why this notice of claim provision should require the notice as soon as possible after the incident itself that gives rise to the claim, rather than as soon as possible after the liability of the underinsured motorist carrier has been established by virtue of resolution of the underlying claim.
All right, could you help me out now with the county's insurance policy? There's been a suggestion made that there that Mr. Shugarts couldn't know that there was going to be an underinsured claim because there was still the possibility that the county's insurance policy would cover his claim. What do we do with that?
Well, first of all, I think as the Court of Appeals pointed out, the mistaken possibility that there could be coverage under a different policy does not excuse the failure to comply with the policy provisions regarding the proof of claim. I know that the explanation that has been given is that there was a belief that the Truth in Auto legislation would change the existing case law, but if you look at the Truth in Auto legislation, it didn't really have anything to do with this exclusion that had been upheld by this court for employees of a municipality. So I don't think that was a reasonable belief. I think that all parties have the responsibility to be familiar with what the law is and to try to comply with it. So I don't think the fact that there was a belief that there was other underinsured motorist coverage that was available is a sufficient excuse for failing to provide the required notice under a different policy.
Well, how far does that argument take you? Because I understand that there was some argument that with respect to Progressive, they might not owe any coverage at all because of its intentional acts exclusion.
Correct.
Right? So what if that had been true? Would it have been incumbent upon Mr. Shugarts to make notice even earlier?
I think so. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals said in their decision. And if you look at Yokichur, it talks about the resolution of the case, including the denial of the claim.
Right, but let's say the resolution occurred when it did occur, but there was the possibility a live possibility, there might not be any coverage under Progressive whatsoever. Should Mr. Shugarts have been on notice at that point, at the beginning of his lawsuit, that his underinsured claim might be $700,000 instead of $650,000?
Well, I think that Mr. Shugarts certainly should have reacted to the fact that the claim was denied by Progressive, and I think that it was reasonably possible for him to give notice at that time, as pointed out by the Court of Appeals. If I'm missing the question, I apologize. Well, but
you got it. Thank you.
All right.
Anything about the Court of Appeals decision you disagree with?
I think that I know that we argued in the Court of Appeals that perhaps the notice provision and the liability policy could be read into the UIM coverage, but honestly, I think that's a non-starter, so I would say no, there's not anything that I disagree with.
Do you agree with the Court of Appeals opinion that Mr. Shugarts was in a position to provide notice, I'm just going to leave it at that, to Allstate by August of 2013?
Well, I do.
And that was 3 years after the accident.
It was.
And Allstate essentially got notice 4 years after the accident, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Shugarts makes the argument, I'm going back to the prejudice issue, that how could Allstate be prejudiced 4 years after an accident, but not 3 years after the accident, still a great amount of time after the accident? How do you respond to that?
Well, I guess the way I respond to that is that there's still a 14-month interval, perhaps as long as 15 months, and that the statute, 631.81 sub 1, does state that if this notice is not given within 1 year of the time that's required under the policy, that there's a presumption of prejudice.
And it's on Mr. Shugarts to rebut that, right?
And it's on Mr. Shugarts to rebut that, and that there's been no showing that the information that Allstate could have gotten 14 months earlier would not have been better than the information that they could have got when the notification was received by Allstate.
Do you think that Mr. Shugarts should have been given the opportunity to conduct discovery to make his claim? I hate to use that language in another context, but to make his case for why Allstate was not prejudiced. My understanding, based on my review of the record, that Allstate denied him the opportunity to take depositions and discovery with respect to that issue. So if we agree with your position up to that point, should we remand for a determination of prejudice after the fact finder has an opportunity to explore that issue?
Well, first of all, I would dispute the fact that Mr. Shugarts was denied the opportunity to do discovery. I mean, the lawsuit was filed in March of 2015, and the summary judgment wasn't until a year later. I don't recall that there's anything in the record that says that Allstate wouldn't allow any discovery.
Well, it's in the briefing that Mr. Shugarts was not allowed to depose Allstate employees with respect to that issue or at all.
Well, I got to tell you, Your Honor, I don't think that that's true. I think the problem that the trial court had with the submission that was made by the plaintiff relative to prejudice was that there really wasn't any submission. I mean, if you look at the cases where the presumption of prejudice was overcome, I mean, one of the cases, there was a deposition of a claims manager who said that they wouldn't have done anything different.
I have to back up and ask you something. I was listening to your discussion of 631.81.
Yes.
As if it sets a one-year limit.
How do you get that
out of 631.81?
I'm sorry. I misspoke if I said that. I think it's the Jared Realty case, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that interprets the statute in that way. It's not the statute itself, so I apologize.
Right, because the words of the statute say as soon as reasonably possible and within 1 year after the time required by the policy. So it drives you back to the policy and the language of the policy.
It does.
Okay.
It does. I apologize for
that. I wanted to make sure I was looking at the right version of this. Or
no, that was my fault. Okay. It's a case that interpreted the statute that came up with that rule.
Fair enough. Thank you.
All right. So addressing the issue of prejudice, I think that this court, when it has looked at the issue of prejudice, has recognized the right of an insurance company to do a prompt investigation, to have the opportunity to question witnesses at as early a stage as possible while their memories are still fresh, before they become entrenched in positions, before they are in a point where they understand the legal ramifications of their testimony.
And counsel, but in this case, there really isn't a claim here that there was any contributory negligence, is there, by the officer?
No, I don't think
so.
There
really
would be.
All you need to know in regard to what you're going to pay or not pay is how much damages have accumulated because of the accident, right?
Well, there could have been other coverage issues that would have been implicated, too.
I mean, like what?
I would point out that Progressive had a denial of coverage that was based on intentional acts. I think certainly we would have wanted to interview the people that were involved in the accident to see what the circumstances of the accident were. I think that the ability to take either the statement or the sworn
but,
proof
but
of
intentional conduct in a first-party coverage, intentional conduct of the tortfeasor can't really have any bearing on first-party UIM coverage, can it?
You know, I apologize. I haven't reviewed that issue in
okay,
detail.
I was just trying to understand
this argument.
The prejudice part of this case, because to me it seems quite different from an allegation of prejudice when there's a concern about contributory negligence, because you want to investigate the circumstance, the accident, was your insured partially at fault, that may have a bearing on what you have to pay or you don't have to pay. But when you don't have liability to contend with and all you're focusing on is damages, I guess I was just looking at this as, well, you have more information now than you would have had the day after the accident on what his damages are from the accident, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think the only thing I was trying to suggest is that there might have been an investigation to look at the policy more closely and see whether there was perhaps a basis that there would be no coverage aside from the fact that the notice of claim was not provided.
Okay, that's thank you.
That's not something you'd want to do, though, right?
I'm sorry?
That's not something you'd want to do.
You mean meaning Allstate?
Right. Do an investigation to discover perhaps this was not intentional. That would just drive up your exposure.
Honestly, I think that Allstate's motivation would be just to investigate the cases as thoroughly and completely as they could.
And in this case, that investigation wouldn't have changed your liability, your exposure to liability at all, because they tendered their limits, right?
Well, I don't think it would have affected the issue of contributory negligence, certainly. I would agree with that. And they did tender their limits. They didn't do it right away, but they did tender their limits, so I agree with that.
Right. So there's the inability to do an investigation in this case, not as a general rule, but in this case, the inability to do an investigation did not prejudice Allstate at all.
You know, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't feel like I'm in a position to concede that.
Okay. So what would you point to for the reason for not conceding that?
Well, I think that if we would have got notice earlier on, we would have wanted to exercise our right to either take a statement from the insured or take an examination under oath. We certainly would have wanted to interview the person who was involved running from the police in the police chase, to find out what the circumstances were, what the motivation was. There's a very extensive police supplemental report that includes all kinds of information we might have wanted to follow up on. We may have wanted to have a medical professional look at Mr. Shugart's at an earlier stage while the injuries were more acute, rather than looking at it at a later stage when the injuries become more chronic. So I do believe that there is an interest that is implicated by this provision that's an issue in this case.
How would that impact your coverage obligations under the UIM provisions of your policy?
The investigation?
whatever you found out, how would it have an impact on UIM?
Well, honestly, I guess that would depend what we found out. I would have to go back to the policy and carefully examine, you know, the granting language and the exclusions and see if any of the investigative measures that were taken would have implicated anything other than the notice defense. The notice defense is the defense that we decided to proceed on because we felt it was the strongest defense.
Right, but just conceptually, what could you have found? I mean, really, at this juncture, all you need to know is how much do you need to pay for his coverage, right?
Well, that would be important. My red light is on. Do you want me?
Yes, you can answer that question. Thank
you.
What
could we have found? Honestly, that's difficult to say without having had the opportunity. I mean, I think we're looking in retrospect. I think that the plaintiff could have done some discovery on the issue of prejudice, and that wasn't done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. There's a lot to respond to, and I might jump around a little bit. I first want to focus on this prejudice issue. Just to make it clear, we don't believe that the court should even get to that issue. So the issue about possibly remanding this court for this case for more fact-finding about prejudice, we don't believe the court should even get to that point. Because in order to get to that point, you have to first conclude that notice wasn't timely provided under the policy. And we believe notice was provided timely under the policy. But if you get to the prejudice issue, other than a remand, you could say, based on these facts, that there is no prejudice as a matter of law. So it's not just a matter of if you get to prejudice, do we have to remand? Counsel already made references to the fact that this involved a deputy sheriff in the line of duty. So these types of accidents are thoroughly investigated. There are contemporaneous reports that are available. And, in fact, if you look at the vote letter that is part of the record, it summarizes the results of that investigation, and copies of the investigation file were provided to Allstate. That was in February of 15. And so in some cases, when you don't have a law enforcement officer involved as being involved in the accident, you may only have the bare-bones minimum DOT accident report where there's no further information. This is not such a case. The issue about medical records, we take medical records, we take written medical records for a reason. It's so that doctors and patients years later don't have to rely on their memories about what were discussed at doctor visits and what the diagnoses and treatment options were. The medical records are available. If Mr. Shugarts were to be deposed today and give testimony about his injuries that's inconsistent with what's set forth in the records are there to, in a polite way of saying it, refresh his recollection, in a more pejorative way, impeach his testimony based on prior records. So there really is no prejudice here. I want to focus on the Martinson case. That's a prior decision of this court. It involved uninsured motorist coverage. We have to concede that the language before the court in that case was very similar to the notice provision at issue under the UIM coverage of Allstate's policy. And that the court in that case interpreted as soon as possible to mean after the incident giving rise to the claim, after the accident. But that doesn't control this case for two important reasons. Number one, uninsured motorist coverage, as we've said, is $1 coverage. It pays in place of the liability coverage the at-fault driver should have but did not have. So for that reason, it is important for an uninsured motorist insurance company to get notice right away because they're going to be paying the $1 benefits. That's different than underinsured motorist coverage, which we've talked about. It's excess. It doesn't even get triggered until the underlying layer of coverage is fully paid. That's number one. Secondly, interesting about the Martinson case, there was a separate provision that appeared in that policy that does not appear in Allstate's policy, and that was a notice of suit provision. There was a provision in Martinson that required the insurer, if they filed a lawsuit against the legally responsible party, to provide a copy of the summons and complaint to the insurance company so that the insurance company theoretically could intervene. Now, the interesting thing there is a UM company, given that they are $1 first dollar coverage, they would have the right to intervene in a lawsuit that their insured files against someone, the tortfeasor, that may not have insurance, unlike an underinsured motorist carrier that has no right to intervene until the underlying limits are paid. So the insured violated two provisions. He didn't provide notice as soon as possible, after the accident, and he didn't give a copy of the summons and complaint of the lawsuit he had filed to the insurance company. Now, there was a dispute in that case about oral conversations that allegedly took place between counsel and the insurance company, but this court didn't consider it because they were disputed. So the Martinson case doesn't control here. We get back to the issue of, would it be helpful for an insurance company that may have to pay underinsured motorist benefits to get earlier notice of that before the time when the liability insurer has offered the limits to trigger the vote notice? Before you consummate the deal, sign the release, you have to give notice to your UIM insurance company so they can make the decision whether to allow you to settle and release the tortfeasor, which would void their subrogation claim or give them the right to substitute their money. Of course, it may be helpful for an insurance company to get notice earlier than that point in time about a claim. That's not the issue. The issue is, did Allstate's policy require notice to be given at an earlier point in time? And it did not. We've talked about it. As soon as possible, comma, you or a person making a claim, and so the issue is, when is that triggered? Is it triggered from the accident? It doesn't say as soon as possible after the accident. The word accident appears nowhere in there. And so that's not the issue. The issue is not whether notice could have been provided earlier. The issue is not even whether it would be good practice to provide notice earlier. The issue is whether there's a requirement under the law or policy to provide earlier notice, and there's not. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, thank you all for very interesting arguments. This was our second insurance company case today, and just when we think we know all the wrinkles of insurance, we find out we do not. So thank you very much for bringing to us very interesting issues. The court is going to adjourn now, and we'll meet in closed session at 1:30. I will be down to chat with those students who wake up, and if you're not awake when I get down there, I bet you I will wake you up when I get down. We are adjourned.